This is the BBC.
Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Welcome to Desert Island Discs, where every week I ask my guests to choose the 8 tracks, the book and the luxury item that they'd want to take with them if they were cast away on a desert island. For rights reasons, the music on these podcast versions is shorter than in the original broadcast. You can find over 2,000 more editions to listen to and download on the Desert Island Discs website. My castaway this week is the musician David Byrne. Talking Heads was his band through the 70s and 80s. It occupied a central but skew-whiff position in pop culture, dislocated, witty, ambiguous and twitching, taking new wave existential angst and fashioning it into catchy chart toppers. Psycho Killer, Road to Nowhere and Burning Down the House are just a few of the band's best-known hits. But unlike so many of his contemporaries, his was not a talent that could easily be wrung out by the music business and left for dead. In the ensuing decades, his work scoring movies, writing books, staging art installations, and most recently collaborating with neuroscientists, points to a man with significant creative reach. A beguilingly unconventional presence, he has nonetheless captivated the establishment, collecting an Academy Award, a Golden Globe, and a Grammy along the way. He says, "For my whole life, I have attempted to make works that hover in the zone between the high and the low, the known and the unknown, the quotidian and the extraordinary. I love to make art that doesn't announce itself as art. And that, of course, includes pop music. So welcome."
Thank you. It's a lovely island. I'm very happy that this massive sound system washed up on the beach.
It's very lucky. You've been making sound and many other things for around about 40 years now. Are you one of those people, having spent so much time in music, working in music, where when you listen, you inevitably listen with a highly tuned professional ear, or can you ever lose yourself in music?
Oh, I totally lose myself in music. Just now, when we were kind of checking out some of these tracks, I was kind of moving and singing along. But I also, at the same time, listen with a slightly analytical ear, the way a professional musician would do. And you're listening to the way the song is constructed, or the arrangement, or the approach that the vocalist is taking, all those sort of things. And you're going, listen to that.
When it comes to asking anybody to compile a list of 8 discs they couldn't leave without, I mean, it's a cheeky thing to do as a premise, but I think to ask a musician to do it is almost outrageous. What was your premise for picking your 8 today? What did you want them to illustrate?
I picked things that are kind of little stepping stones in my life in music, things that I heard as a child, things that influenced my musical decisions, my musical awareness. So these are not current favorites.
Yeah.
These are things that are kind of take me back to my childhood and then almost up to present day.
Tell me about your first choice then, David Byrne. What is this and why is it on your list?
First one is fairly present day. This is Halsey. It's her song Bad at Love. And she gave a memorable speech at the Women's March.
Yeah, so in January of this year.
Yeah. Really amazing speech. And you listen to the song. It's a good song. And you realize she's got something to say in the song as well. She's very aware, very conscious. It's a pop song, but it really does have something to say. And you thought, okay, this is worth cheering.
Got a boy back home in Michigan. And it tastes like Jack when I'm kissing him. So I told him that I never really liked his friends. Now he's gone and he's calling me a bitch again. There's a guy that lives in a garden state. And he told me that we make it till we graduate. So I told him that the music will be worth the wait. But he wants me in the kitchen when it's dinner plate. I believe that we're meant to be. But jealousy, 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 jealousy get the best of me. Look, I don't mean to frustrate, but I always make the same mistakes. Yeah, always make the same mistakes, 'cause I'm bad in love.
That was Halsey and Bad in Love. So, David Byrne, your parents were from Glasgow. You spent the first 3 years of your life in Dumbarton, and you made the journey, your family, to North America. Can you describe your father and mother to me? First of all, your dad.
They were, I would say, or this, I kind of figured this out later, a mixed marriage. Dad's family was Catholic.
Right.
Mum's family was sort of Protestant, Presbyterian, etc.
And a very big deal in 40s and 50s Glasgow.
Yes, which I didn't realise so much at the time. And I started asking them about it later and I thought, might have had something to do with why they left. But Dad had studied engineering in Glasgow. And Glasgow did not have a lot of work at that time. Shipyards were little by little closing down, the steel, this and that. It was not a place where you could see a lot of future in that. So a lot of American companies, in this case Westinghouse, were reaching out and offering trained people like my dad. They were offering them a job.
And so your parents said they'd come from relatively modest backgrounds, you know, that sort of educated working class background where betterment was part of the journey.
Exactly, that was it. They were working class, but looking back, I sensed that they wanted economic betterment, and I think they probably wanted to be free of all the kind of mixed marriage religious stuff. It was quite oppressive. You had members of the family saying, you marry her, we're not talking to you anymore.
Really?
That sort of thing. And Jean just thought, well, you know, they're a young couple trying to start a life. They have a kid. That was me. And they're probably thinking, why do we need this extra burden?
Did they hold their Scottishness close to them once they were in America, or did they sort of cut that loose as well?
I would say we had more or less Scottish food.
This was in Canada at first. Yeah.
And a lot of Scots emigrated to Canada. A lot of the food was just the normal thing, potatoes and stews and mince and
all the good stuff.
A real meal.
In what way did they encourage your creativity as a kid?
I would say by example. They played music around the house. Dad was an amateur painter. Things that you could say were influenced by, say, Matisse or Gauguin or this kind of thing. I have one at home now. The funny part was, being a Scot, if he found a nice frame, he would take a saw and cut off part of the picture to fit the frame.
Okay. Did they speak with Scottish accents even when they lived in America? Were they people who kept their accents?
Yes. Oh, yeah. I had an accent as well, but lost it when they moved to the United States. Funny, in Canada, the other kids could understand me fine, but in Baltimore, they obviously couldn't understand me. And a child of that age wants desperately to fit in, not stick out. My friends would say, what are your parents saying? We don't understand them.
Tell me about your second David Byrne. What are we going to hear?
So I started thinking about the kind of music that was played around the house. This is the Rowan Tree, a Gene Redpath. I wouldn't say it was a great favorite of mine, but years later, now I can look at some of the melodies I've written over the years, and I go, oh, there's a real Celtic influence in some of the melodies I've done. They follow the same kind of melodic arc as this song.
Rowan Tree, Gene Redpath. David Byrne, tell me about your home life. I'm interested in, you know, your parents, as you say, kind of go ahead, slightly cutting free of their background. What was the chat around the dinner table?
Sometimes politics came up at the dinner table. Dad was staunchly kind of left-leaning.
Right.
Sometimes he'd pontificate and quote George Bernard Shaw. And Mum, she felt the same way, but was a more heartfelt, sentimental left-leaner than Dad.
And she became, in her later years, a sort of peace activist.
She became a peace activist. She was also a teacher teaching mentally challenged kids in a public high school. And she got her degree and all that.
One of the reasons I'm really interested in this is that so much of your music in the beginning dealt a lot with this kind of suburban dislocation, this idea that we are in our lives, but we are other people than we are representing ourselves as. And you have said, my parents fostered a little bit of a view of us as outsiders. So the sense in which you were going through the motions, but there was other stuff as well. Does that sound
Yes.
Reasonable?
Yes, it does. There wasn't, it wasn't a lot of conscious reminding us.
Yeah.
It wasn't them constantly saying, we're different than those others.
Sure.
But it was, you couldn't avoid it. People around us in the States, they ate with just a fork. They would cut their food and then put the knife aside and then gather it up with just their fork. And I thought, that seems really inefficient.
They still do that, too.
They still do that. So just as a child, you realize that we eat with a knife and fork. We're different than our neighbors. And if I could say so, I think our way's better.
Tell me about the reel-to-reel tape machine that your father adapted for you.
Dad, being an engineer, he was able to do things with electronics. And at some point, I remember, he had a reel-to-reel tape recorder, and it came with a microphone. And so when I got to be an adolescent, I was learning guitar and was playing with it a lot. And Dad acknowledged my interest, and he modified the tape recorder so that you could record what's called sound on sound. And it's a kind of multi-track recording.
Right.
So that you can put down a guitar track and then play that and sing along with it and then add something else and add something else and add something else. And I would do things like cut up tapes and scramble them and put them back together again. I did these multi-track things with loads and loads of feedback and, you know, all sorts of things.
Did it delight you at the time?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Totally exciting.
It's time now for some more music. David Byrne, what have we got next?
This goes back to politics in a way. Another folk song, but this is Woody Guthrie singing Do Re Mi. It has elements of, intentionally kind of elements of being like a children's song, but it's actually about, you think you're going to do fine if you Okies who are heading for California, but if you don't have the money, you're not going to make it.
Lots of folks back east, they say's leaving home every day, beating the hot old dusty way to the California line. Across the desert sands they roll, getting out of that old dust bowl. They think they're going to a sugar bowl, but here's what they find. Now the police at the port of entry say, you're number 14,000 for today. Oh, if you ain't got the do-re-mi, folks, you ain't got the do-re-mi.
That was Woody Guthrie and do-re-mi. David Byrne, were you a shy child?
I was a very shy child. I've heard from friends some of my shy behavior is quite extreme. I would have a party at my house, and then I would go and hide. Someone would find me in a bedroom. Or I'd go to dinner at someone else's house and kind of sit on the side and not say anything the whole time. And I would often latch on to a friend who was more sociable than I was. Right. So I could tag along, and they would be the one that would do all the socializing, but I could be there.
Yeah.
And my wife at the time, later on, was much more sociable than I was, so which was maybe not the best kind of relationship, you know, balance in the relationship, but I gradually changed. But a lot of people asked me, well, if you were so shy, how could you possibly get on stage?
Well, of course, that was what I was just about to ask you.
And to me, it seemed self-evident. It seemed like, well, if you're really shy, you have to get on stage because that's the only way you can make your presence felt or make your ideas known or announce the fact of your existence. You can do that because it's an artificial situation, and then you can retreat back into your shell right after. And that's what I did.
So when did you first want to perform? When did you first get up on stage?
I was in high school. I would perform at the college and other coffee shops and folk places. I would play guitar, I'd play ukulele or violin or whatever and sing.
Is it true that you were thrown out of the school choir?
Well, not exactly thrown out, but told that probably I shouldn't continue.
Well, why?
Well, if you've heard my singing on some of the early Talking Heads records...
I very much enjoyed it.
Yes. It's okay, but it can get into a yelp. There's a yelpy aspect to it. And I can only imagine that it might have been more so back then. Although somehow I must have been able to kind of manage to sing in a normal way when I was singing in these coffee shops and singing these songs and accompanying myself.
Tell me then about your fourth one of the day. What are we going to hear now? Why is it on the list?
Okay, we're jumping ahead. It's a little bit later. I'm not a child anymore. And I had a transistor radio. Terrible sound, but you could listen to it in your bedroom, either put it under your pillow so the parents couldn't hear it. So I remember hearing this song performed by the Byrds. I didn't know at the time that it was a Bob Dylan song. And this was a pop hit. And from the very beginning, from the opening sound, I thought, wow, this is really different. The sound, it was like nothing else I'd heard. And that and other things that I was hearing kind of tells you as a kid in the suburbs that there's another world out there. There's things being made that are made for us, whoever us is. And I have to go and find them.
That was the Byrds and Mr. Tambourine Man, and beautifully described, David Byrne, that sort of moment of epiphany that so many of us recognise from our late teenage years. So you were beginning to explore performance and you were in a small band, and there were, I've read, and I can't quite piece enough of this together for it to make sense, but I've read about a performance. By this time you had a kind of long, straggly beard, I think. There was a performance where you shaved your beard off.
Yeah.
Can you explain what happened to me?
Yeah, I was making music with a friend at around this time. I was making visual art at the same time. And the school would show European films, like Fellini films. So another world had opened up. And I decided, oh, we'll do a performance. And as part of it, I'll shave my beard off on stage, which is a little hard to do without a mirror. So there was a bit of blood. People cut themselves shaving. It doesn't hurt that much, but the blood can gush.
And it did.
Yes, it did.
Do you believe, I wonder, in such a thing as pretentiousness? And do you think it has a role in creativity?
Yes, it's given a...
It gets a bad rap,
right? It gets a bad rap. And I think if it's done in the right way, you can deal with big questions. And that's the best part of pretentiousness. It's just feeling free to try something else.
And this freedom thing really does interest me with you, because I think one of your attractions for people who've enjoyed your work is your ability to embrace your, I was going to say inner audible, but sometimes not that much inner, sometimes very outer. You know, you're kind of doing that on our behalf, because most of us are not comfortable to do that. What does it feel like to do it?
It feels, sorry, my inner oddball.
Is
my
that
outer
fine?
Oddball.
No.
It's absolutely true. I'm most of the time completely unaware of it, although I'm aware that people sometimes find it amusing or strange. And I've gotten to the point now where I'm not intimidated by that, which is, I guess, a good thing. If I do something, I thought, well, that was fun. I'm not going to apologize for that. I remember once I was traveling in Iceland, and to go up by the glaciers, you had to have a driver in a special kind of car. Mm. And I was fiddling with my camera, and the camera would do things, you know, beep, 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 it would make little noises as you kind of adjusted the settings. And I would kind of mimic the noises. It would do something and I would go, beep, 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 and I would be kind of just sitting there going, beep, 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 beep. And the driver said to me, "Do you always talk to your machines?"
To which the answer was what?
Yeah, why not?
Let's have some more music, David Byrne. Tell me about this. It's your fifth of the day.
Ah, okay. So if the Mr. Tambourine Man song was kind of an adolescent introduction to the kind of the world of pop music, that became kind of familiar, whether it was the Beatles or the Rolling Stones or James Brown or the Temptations. Then later on, in the probably early 70s, you start to encounter things that are really different than that are using that language, but are coming from a place that, again, you didn't know existed. And one of the groups that was doing that was the Stooges, Iggy Pop and the Stooges. To me, this music, it was emotional, pure id outburst, but it was also very clever and consciously and creatively done. The name of the song is I Want to Be Your Dog, which, although it's there's nothing particular in the song that says this, you realize there's a hint of kind of another kind of sexual world that's being implied here. So that's another thing when you go, what's he talking about?
That was the Stooges, and I Want to Be Your Dog. You spoke going into that, David Byrne, about the idea that that new wave, early 70s music, was, of course, building on the traditions of the much more traditional stuff that had come before, like the Birds and so on. I'm wondering, for those of us who were there, as it were, and heard Talking Heads music when it first came out, you know, it represented sort of high watermark in that new age music that was being produced in the early and mid-70s. In the beginning, what were your creative rules when you were writing and performing? You're smiling now.
Yeah, I'm smiling. I'm laughing about the idea of having rules, which we kind of did. Sometimes I think they were kind of unspoken, but they were there. We were not going to imitate rock and roll, poses, singing styles, clothes. I wanted to use language that was not typical of pop music. There was no like long, noodly guitar solos. Well, that was verboten. No posturing. Everything was going to be stripped down to the bottom. We were going to basically reinvent everything from scratch, which maybe was unnecessary, but we should dress like normal people. Of course, we didn't dress like normal people, so we had to appropriate something that sort of looked like normal people. At one point, living downtown, I sometimes would see the business people going to work and that, and I thought, well, I should wear a little suit. So I went down to the financial district and got myself a cheap suit and realized that in a club, it's just way too hot. And then I threw it in the wash and it shrunk down to nothing.
So that was the little suit. What about the big suit? Of course, you know, from Jonathan Demme's landmark film in 1984, Stop Making Sense, it featured you famously, and it's the man with the tiny head wearing the big suit.
There's a line connecting those. There's an idea of the everyman in a suit, which I still do. But I went from trying to kind of camouflage myself as an everyman to making a kind of statement by kind of enlarging the suit to giant size. The man is lost in his suit.
Yes.
And by that point, the band and I had little by little learned how to do things like have instrumental sections or dance on stage or do theatrical things in a way that we felt belonged to us.
It's reported that you split up amid much acrimony, and that's not all that unusual in the music business. But do you regret that it ended that way?
Yes, I wish it didn't end the way it did, although I think musically we ended on a good note. But personally, yes, it was not done very cleanly or honestly, yeah, a bit of a mess.
Were you difficult to work with?
I can imagine I was. I think not so much now.
No, because I was looking at photographs yesterday of you then, and you look so relaxed now. In photographs from back then, you look pretty angsty.
Yeah, a little bit angsty and very, very focused to the extent where it's like, it must be done this way. I have a vision that it has to be like this, which is maybe understandable when you're trying something new and you're not sure if other people get it.
Yeah.
And it means the absolute world to you. It's your baby. It's your soul. It's everything you've dreamed of that you're putting together, and you don't want it to be compromised. But now I've learned that you can work with people and sometimes get something in a way that's not so dictatorial.
Let's have your sixth, David Byrne. What are we going to hear now?
Okay, so we heard the Stooges. At the same time that the other Talking Heads and I, we listened to a lot of R&B and dance music, disco, James Brown and Parliament Funkadelic. Parliament Funkadelic was kind of the more outrageous, theatrical, philosophical aspect of R&B at that time. It made you realize that there's all sorts of possibilities, that pop music, dance pop music, funk, it can talk about things in a way that's kind of sly and funny, but also saying something quite profound.
Ready or not, here we come, getting down on the one which we believe in. Can I get it on my good foot? Good God. About time I got down on the end.
We're on the move, but they can stop us now.
Ha, 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 ha. Don't tell me now.
That was Funkadelic and One Nation Under a Groove. David Byrne, you've written operas, you've written film scores, you publish books, you do photography, blog about cycling even. So much of your work, not just musically, but in exhibitions and in books, you know, you constantly pose questions for the viewer or the listener, the consumer of your work. But interestingly, you always seem to rather resist coming up with answers. I presume that's entirely deliberate.
Yeah, it's entirely deliberate. I've been doing this series of talks, and it's me sort of pointing to things that other people have done. So it's not me saying, do this, but it's more saying, look, someone's done something, it seems to be working. Just saying, look what I found. But the songs that I write and a lot of the other things I do are more about asking the questions, asking, what do we do? Who are we? What kind of people are we? What kind of person am I? All that sort of thing.
And there we are. I wonder how much for this chronically shy teenager that we were talking about and kid. How are you with your fame now?
It's mild. I get around New York on a bicycle. I do here, too, but not today. Last night I had a bite to eat in a restaurant in Notting Hill with a friend, and a kid, he must have been like 18 or something, jumped out of the restaurant. He had an Eastern European accent, and he wanted a selfie. I thought, well, I was incredibly flattered. I was incredibly flattered, right?
As well you should be for the attentions of a teenager. Tell me then about your seventh. What are we going to hear now, David Byrne?
Wow, okay. In the probably late 80s, I started listening to a lot of Latin music. And at one point I went bin diving in Rio and got this record by a guy named Tom Zay. There's elements of Brazil folkloric music and Brazilian pop music all mixed together in a way that to me said, wow. So this is one where he's got the instruments playing what in music would be called a hocket technique, where different musicians are playing different notes on different instruments. And then eventually Mr. Zay comes in playing some power tools.
Let's hear it. That was Tong Zay and Talk. You were laughing quite a lot, or at least smiling through much of that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean,
David,
you can hear it goes from power tool to a typewriter, all sorts of things, very ahead of its time.
Tell me this, David Byrne. What do you consider your greatest achievement?
God, I don't know. Let's come back to that.
Okay, because I'm thinking about your role as a parent, and I'm thinking about...
Yeah, that's what everybody would say.
I know
that.
I know
that's such a cliched thing. My greatest achievement is my daughter. But that, which is true.
But you wouldn't want to say that.
No, because every parent would say that.
But if it's true.
It's true. And it's also so mysterious and magical. You know, coming from me, she could have been such a mess. But she's not. She's not a mess. And she's very happy. And what more could you want?
Nothing more than that. I mean, I love that you're honest enough to say that. I mean, obviously, she's grown up now. But when you were a parent... How did you get on with that? You know, there's a lot of very conventional elements to being a responsible parent.
Oh,
could you do it?
Yeah, I could do it, but there was a conflict. Probably no surprise. It was at some early on period where you're confronted with all the responsibilities of being a parent and pushing a pram around and things like that. I thought, oh, that's not me. I can't be pushing a pram around. But I did. But at the same time, it was kind of like, grit your teeth and push the pram.
Yeah. It's so good that you are very, very honest about that. So you did pitch up and you did do those things, but you felt like you were sort of betraying yourself by doing
it. In a certain way, which is very silly.
That is very silly.
It's very silly, but it's true.
What do you think? You know, this is Desert Island Discs, of course, so I'm going to cast you away to a desert island. How will you be all by yourself on a tiny island with no one for company?
I'll probably go crazy after a while, but I think solitude is also very undervalued.
Do you need it in your life?
Oh,
do you build it in?
Absolutely, absolutely. Yes. Not all the time, but there are plenty of times when I love just going out to a restaurant by myself, sitting at a counter with a book or reading on a tablet or whatever it might be. And I'm very happy doing that. But I'm aware that some people give me a look like, oh, poor man, doesn't have any friends. Oh, God, look at that. At this point in his life, you'd think he'd have some friends.
Tell me, David Byrne, about your final piece of music then. What are we going to hear now?
Okay, this is another obvious influence in kind of two different ways. It's a gospel song and called Stand on the Word, the Joubert Singers, but it's mixed by Larry Levan. And Larry Levan was one of the great DJs at Paradise Garage in the early days of club music. And what's interesting is that gospel music, if you listen to the lyrics, it's like, do what the Lord says, which is probably not the kind of ideas you would be putting forward in the Paradise Garage. But musically, it all fits.
That was the Joubert Singers and Stand on the Word. It's time now, David, for me to give you the books. Every castaway gets the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare, and you get to take one other book along. What's your book going to be?
It's really difficult. I'm just going to be very practical and take along the one I haven't finished reading yet, Oliver Sacks' new book,
okay.
River of Consciousness, I think it's called. And I thought, well, I want to finish it.
Okay, that's a very reasonable thing to do, so we shall give you that book. Every castaway is allowed a luxury as well to make life, make something more bearable.
Could be a cookbook or a set of cookbooks. In the last couple of months, I've been discovering the uses of fish sauce, used in a lot of Vietnamese, Thai, Chinese.
It's nam pla, right? Isn't it that fish sauce?
Yeah,
do you want
that
or do you want the books? You know, the cookbook.
Can't have them both, can
you
I?
Can't have them both. No.
But I'm on a desert island. I could catch some fish. And
that's true.
So I can make my own.
So some Vietnamese cookbooks.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Okay, let's give you those as your luxury. If I were to force you, and I'm about to do this, to pick just one of the eight discs to save, which one disc would be yours?
Ah, I'm going to go with the one we just heard. Stand on the Word. I was kind of moving and grooving to that as it was playing. And I thought, let's keep that rolling.
Okay, let's give you that. David Byrne, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this edition of Desert Island Discs. You'll find over 2,000 interviews with artists, musicians, scientists, sports stars, comedians and more at bbc.co.uk/Desert Island Discs. And I have a favour to ask. If you could rate and review the Desert Island Discs podcast wherever you download your podcasts, it'll really help other people find us. Thanks again for listening.
This is the BBC.
Hello there. We hope you enjoyed that podcast, but as Lieutenant Columbo so presciently put it, there's just one more thing.
Why not consider listening to The Now Show as part of the Friday night comedy from the BBC?
No, I'm sure Columbo never said that.
Then he was missing out, wasn't he?
It's the topical comedy show hosted by us, Puns and Dennis.
All you have to do is find us wherever you get your podcasts and make sure you subscribe.